Hi, this is Garance Frankie Ruta calling, and I am speaking today with Jessica Stern, who has written a new book called Denial, A Memoir of Terror, and who is an expert on terrorism and terrorists. And we are going to talk today about the book and many other issues that it raises. And I should just start by saying that I have not done many author interviews in the past, and also have certainly not done one of this particular nature on a book like this that is obviously about a lot of really emotionally powerful subjects. so there were many reasons I wound up picking up this book. I think initially the first one is I was intrigued by the idea of making the kind of turn that you made in writing this book from being someone who has specialized in the sort of hard and quote hard masculine arenas of political and cultural inquiry into writing a book that is more inward looking and also more related to the topic of being female. But there were many other questions that were raised by this book, which we can get into over the course of our discussion. And I guess I'll start by asking for you to describe a bit about what professional and personal questions you were seeking to delve into in writing this. And and probably more importantly, in reporting it.
Yes.
Because it's a reported book.
Yes, it is. I'm used to interviewing people, and it becomes, well, as you are, I'm sure, and it becomes sort of a habit. It's a way for me to explore issues that I think are important. In this case, I was trying to learn about my own rape, my own rapist, and why I reacted to the rape, which occurred when I was 15 years old, the way I did. And I went about this study in the same way I went about studying terrorists, really. It's funny, I've been very surprised to hear that some people find the book that I'm distant from my emotions, which I didn't feel, but I guess it's the habit of sort of reporting, as you say.
Yes, I think that, to be a reporter is to always maintain a critical distance from the self. I think that's quite right. I guess to begin with, in the process of reporting this book, you were able to uncover that the individual who assaulted you was the police in Massachusetts, now believed responsible for 44 assaults over, I believe, a two- or three-year period, mainly of teenage girls and prepubescent girls. And you were able to interview and track down many of the people who knew him. The individual himself, he was Brian, was dead. And I'm just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the process of writing a book like this, since this is a site that has lots of writers who watch the process of writing a book that is more personal.
Well, it took me a very long time. I started writing my third book about terrorism. This one was going to be Terrorism and Fear, and I had a little vignette about what it feels like to be terrorized, and my editor read that vignette and said, throw out the book. Just write about the rape. And I, you know, at that point, I wasn't even sure that I would identify the I who was the I in that vignette. And I was so upset when he suggested that I didn't even respond for 6 months. But I ended up, as I usually do, following his advice. And it turned into an inquiry into post-traumatic stress disorder. There is a true crime aspect. We think we solved this crime, a serial rapist of children. The police discovered 44 attacks, but in fact, many of the towns near where this rapist grew up didn't keep their records. So, mm-hmm. And not only that, only 1 in 6 women on the typically report a rape, and I don't know what it is for girls. So we don't know. It could be many, many more. But since mm-hmm. the book came out, a number of people have come forward, and mm-hmm. they are also victims of the same guy. And it can be re-traumatizing, I think, to suddenly read about your own rapist, which happened with one of these victims. But she, I think, was relieved to hear that he was dead, which was something she didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Is that Lucy who you mentioned towards the end of the book?
Yeah, no.
This is someone else in addition to her.
Excuse me, I'm so sorry. Come over here.
No, it's fine. Pet appearances are a Blogging Heads classic staple. You could do a whole outtakes reel of pet appearances on Blogging Heads. There's also an outtakes reel on child appearances and, you know, other interesting people wandering into frame. It's the pleasure of Blogging Heads.
Okay. Well, okay. Well, good. I'm glad. The other people, not Lucy. Lucy did identify herself actually as the then 13-year-old daughter of the dean of Harvard Law School. And it's quite extraordinary. There were 20 attacks in an 8-block area around Radcliffe, and even the dean of Harvard Law School didn't know that there had been 11 rapes in the immediate neighborhood, or attacks anyway. And Lucy, her real name, Amy Vorenberg, her younger sister had seen someone peering in the windows, and everybody said, well, you're just imagining things. Had they known that there had been a series of attacks, obviously they would have taken it more seriously. So this is just an incredible story about how Harvard kept this story quiet. It's something that is now, I think, illegal, but
yes, and because people have fought very hard to make it illegal.
Yes, and so this, so many rapes occurred after, both before Lucy, Amy Vorenberg, and afterwards. She was, of the rapes we know of, rapes and attempted rapes, she was number 12, and we discovered 44, and the girl who was raped after my sister and me actually killed herself. So had the police been more on the ball, we would have really protected a lot of girls. But yeah. That's the true crime story. Right. The other story is really about post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. That's what I really tried to do. I realized that this investigation was bringing on symptoms, and that I tried to capture those symptoms. And what was it like writing? I had to take a lot of breaks because mm-hmm. I felt myself stopping feeling. That's what happens. I don't, you know, when you go crazy in this way, you don't throw pots at people. You stop feeling.
Right. I will admit that when I started trying to read your book, I got a terrific headache. it then went away.
Good. I've seen that for people who are trying to learn about trauma, it can be, or if they have this experience themselves, it can be an incredibly emotional experience. But I think it's healing. I mean, I've gotten so many letters saying that it's very hard to read, especially the beginning, but it's enlightening and in the full sense that the person feels much better afterwards, and that's very gratifying to hear that. I hope that happens to you.
Hard to say. One of the things that I thought was sort of interesting, just in terms of my own reading, I mean, what you're saying is about what happened at Harvard in the early 1970s, and the university community not being at all informed is really, for people today, I think.
I'm sorry. Mary Jane, get over here. Get over here. You are being very naughty. People coming in and out of the house, and the dog is getting very upset. I will just keep her here.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
All right. She'll stand guard. I mean, I was there in the late 90s, and in fact, you know, I know one of my college, a girl I knew was assaulted while traveling over spring break, and, you know, she wrote about it immediately at the time because I think during this era, people often do things like that. I know someone else who was accosted on the street, and someone attempted to assault her, and the university community knew all about it by the next day, and I think, you know, people organized a sort of a march on her behalf and you know, to try and sort of encourage her to feel more safe in the community. But it reading your story is it certainly takes one back to this different time, and I think that is something that I don't know if you've had anybody talk to you about doing a movie out of it, but just the whole investigation and the time element and the back and the forth what I sometimes think of basically the sort of the nightmare cultural dislocations of the late 1960s and early 1970s that people, you know, sometimes have continued to live with the consequences of, you know, from the drug culture to the, you know, way certain crimes are handled to the lack of effective police techniques in a lot of regards.
Yes, I you know, the police just couldn't believe that my sister and I didn't know the perpetrator, and they really didn't take it seriously at all. And I think, in a way, they were probably reacting to the so-called sexual revolution, that they thought girls were doing things they found shocking. And I think you're right. I think that it was a period of history that actually there were more rapes during that period. Steven Pinker told me that was a period of heightened risk of rape, stranger rape, which is actually not that common. So it is a kind of historical document in a way.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, I do know that the rate has gone down in recent years, according to the FBI figures, possibly because of DNA testing and possibly because they're able to catch, because of recognition that people are, like Brian B. In your book, serial criminals, and they can maybe catch them earlier.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, that's the theory that I had mm-hmm. read. And so in terms of what you learned about post-traumatic stress, and you close the book out in talking about, you go back and forth between your individual story, the story of what happened to this broader community, the story of what was happening in Massachusetts at that time, where you go to Milford, the town that the rapist is from, and discover it being sort of a hotbed for the dumping of a pedophile priest as well, another one of the scandals that's come to light in recent years, and then go back towards the end of the book into talking about soldiers and the sort of post-traumatic symptoms that they experience in returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I'm just curious what you learned about as someone who studies these things professionally from this process of exploring PTSD.
Well, when I was first diagnosed with PTSD, like many people with PTSD, I didn't believe it.
You were formally diagnosed?
Yes, I was, yeah. And but I thought that was ridiculous. It was a fashionable disease. I mean, diseases do sort of become faddish for a while, I think, especially mental illnesses. And so I just decided I would learn at least a little bit about PTSD, mainly to prove that my analyst was wrong and had fallen prey to this fad.
Mm-hmm.
And then I I was really curious about how people experience it. And, you know, I'd had these altered states really as long as I can remember, actually, where I've gone into a dissociated kind of trance-like state where I feel very sleepy, or hyper-vigilant where I feel very kind of aware, but sometimes irritable. Sounds will annoy me. And if I'm in a situation, certainly I used to be, that if I were in a situation of extreme danger, I'd become actually very calm. I would get afraid of things I shouldn't be afraid of, but when I was in a very dangerous situation, I was very, very calm, thinking very clearly. And actually, it turns out my father has the same experience, but we had never talked about it. You know, mm-hmm. When I think about if a person suddenly started hallucinating, they probably, you know, would consider the possibility they were psychotic if they read about psychosis. I mean, it's sort of described in the lay literature, or bipolar disorder, whereas a post-traumatic stress disorder, dissociation, I never read about it. I didn't know that it was something that was described in the professional literature and that was recognizable as a syndrome rather than just who I was. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. So when I talked to this soldier and when I talked to this victim of clergy sexual abuse, one of the things we talked about was what it feels like, the different altered states that we go into. And it was kind of a shock to discover that how similar the experience of the soldier was to mine when mm-hmm. It seems to be quite physical. This something actually happens in the brain that can be seen, and the brain changes and brain function changes, and it really was a surprise to me. And one of the things I wanted to do with this book was really help families of veterans and rape victims, but to understand what the survivor is going through mentally, emotionally, physically, as a result of what happens to the body mind from too much trauma. I want to be clear that we all have trauma, and most trauma doesn't lead to post-traumatic stress disorder, luckily. It's not, there's a difference between trauma and post-traumatic stress, and there's a difference between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I apparently acquired the disorder.
With a hyperstimulation of the nerves.
Yeah, something snaps, really.
One of the other things I was intrigued by in your book is the question of Germanness and sort of particular characteristics I recognize as sort of Germanic qualities of emotional approach or distance. Your father is a refugee from Germany in the Hitler era and came to the States in 1938, correct?
Yes.
As a 10-year-old. My own father came over in 1936 as an 18-year-old, and though I'm somewhat younger, the different family constructions, there is something about that particular generation of Germans that is really quite interesting. And I thought it was interesting to the way you, it sounded like you were not able to quite distinguish between what was related to sometimes to family ways of coping and to other things.
Yes, this also is one case study of the family of a survivor. My father wasn't in a concentration camp, but he experienced the Nazis quite extensively and was very afraid. And a number of his family members were killed. It is a case study, but unlike my more academic work, I actually didn't want to read about what was typical. I wanted to make sure that I was revealing the experience of my father's denial as he presented it to me, and that I could almost, as I, in essence, interrogate my father about his character and his reaction to my mother's death and to Nazi Germany and to my rape. I also interrogate myself, my own response to him. I didn't want to be, in a way, contaminated by expertise. So, I'm sure that there is a lot about my relationship with my father, a lot about my father's child-rearing style that is typical. And interestingly, German Jews can sometimes be very German in their style of upbringing, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to suggest that it was typical, but just that it was recognizable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I thought that was interesting. It reminded me of there was, you know, just sort of people will get caught for strange reasons into doing or not doing things, and it just reminded me of things. I was also interested, I mean, it sounded like in writing this book, you in many ways sought to not necessarily engage the question of, the framework is a memoir of terror, and the specific form of terror is one that is, typically experienced by women, although not exclusively by any means. And throughout the book, you talk about girls and girliness as this thing that you seem to have a great deal of disdain for, or that is connected to something that you'd like to be apart from.
Yes, this goes back to your first question. I think I was raised in a way. I guess like a boy. It certainly, for my father's generation, I was raised like a boy. We weren't allowed in the house until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, actually. And we had a babysitter who felt sorry for us. But we were supposed to stay outside no matter how cold. And my father said that if we got so cold, too cold, we could build an igloo.
Right.
And he really wanted to toughen us up, and I somehow got this message that to be girly was to be weak and vulnerable, and to be weak and vulnerable was dangerous for the family, that it wasn't just that I would be, I'm making this up, nobody told me this, but that was the message I somehow got, that to be a good team player, you had to be really tough. And
which is probably the message that he received as a child in dealing with the physical abuse at the hands of his classmates.
Yes, that's probably correct. And the kids, the children of Nazis, were just German kids who were encouraged to beat up the Jews. Yes. It was important, I think, in my father's family, too, to just be tough and move on. And that attitude really was, well, I picked it up. You know, I acquired that attitude. I'm not proud of it, but it is definitely something, you know, there are pros and cons.
Right, which is one of the other things that you get to in this book and seek to explore, which is the question of how characteristics that one has can at the same time be sort of the basis of your success and the cause of all your problems, or at least many of them, that, you know, we have these dual-edged swords that are within us.
Yes, I mean, there are a couple of groups of people who have been writing to me. Mm-hmm. And one of them is war correspondents. And mm-hmm. war correspondents are saying, gosh, you know, I really know exactly what you're talking about, that I become calm when endangered. And some have said, I think I'm addicted to living in this kind of situation, addicted to living in a dangerous situation. And I think what happens is, one is very well equipped to deal with danger, and certainly this happens in a war zone. One goes into a state that is life-preserving in a war zone, mm-hmm. but is not life-affirming mm-hmm. at home. And it can be, well, I actually got one really moving email from a psychologist who mm-hmm. said that she is very good at dealing with high-risk situations, and she tries to be a good mother and a good wife, but she thought she was much better at her work, which is just kind of heartbreaking. And I'm one letter, someone saying, you know me, I'm someone who can handle dangerous situations and cannot necessarily handle normal life.
Mm-hmm.
I was intrigued to find that war correspondents were so interested in the book.
That is interesting. I think there are probably lots of people who engage in doing different sorts of things over the course of their life who wind up experiencing really intense and difficult experiences. There was a period in my life where I was doing a lot of work with people with HIV, and knew a lot of people who died. And I worked I also, when I was in college, worked in a hospital, at the Bellevue Hospital emergency rooms on Friday nights, which was very interesting, and sort of getting to know the physicians and, you know, in particular, you know, people, nurses who've been there for 17 years. And in an emergency room like that, you know, people who've seen literally everything that can go wrong in New York City coming through their door screaming, basically, and being the person who is, you know, just manages in the middle of all that to be calm and kind.
Yes.
Capable of a kind of weirdly transcendent connection with someone very, very different over you know, this raw human need that they have for each other,
or
that one has for the other more. And so I think that is definitely something that probably people in a certain number of other professions experience. But I sometimes also wonder if that stilling quality that you describe, I mean, like, where that comes from in human nature, you know, what is that? It seems very primal, that it is something that people experience in some way, that it's, you know, I mean, is that what animals feel like when they get eaten, you know?
Gosh.
You know, that quality of stillness in the middle of chaos and you know, just, I don't know. I wonder how deep it goes in our biology, the capacity for moving in a calculated way in the midst of something very disastrous.
Yes, I mean,
like a war.
I think it's very hard to know in advance how we'll react to abject terror and whether this fight, flight, freeze. I mean, freezing is another reaction. It does feel quite animal, and so does this capacity to remain calm and in chaos. It feels animal. I agree with you. It feels completely physical and like some, it's a chemical reaction. It doesn't feel like something one can control. One couldn't, I mean, it might be nice to bring that on when in certain situations, and I don't think it's something you can will to happen. Or maybe you can train yourself to. Maybe you can, but anyway, I haven't had that training, and I imagine you haven't either.
No. I mean, other than, you know, sort of emergency room context, you know, where, you know, people actually do train each other about how to, you know, remain calm in certain situations. But I think, you know, there's a certain amount of instinctiveness to it. What about the question, I know this is sort of one of the questions in the treatment of PTSD that's come up, is whether or not it's better for people to talk about things versus to just move on. And I know that there's been some debate about that in recent years. Do you have any thoughts on that? Based on the way you've done and the research you've done?
I do think that people are really different, and even those who have PTSD are very, very different. And people have sometimes asked me, do you think it's a good way to recover from rape to go and track down your rapist? And I say,
it's a very Law and Order kind of way.
No, definitely not. I mean, I don't think most people would want to do that. And I wasn't doing it to recover. In fact, doing it, I would say, made me feel ill. I put down, describe what that felt like. The process of writing wasn't healing, but having written, I would say, is healing. And I really could not have done it without a therapist, and with a really steady husband who had an interest in my doing it. Talking about it, not talking about it. Bessel van der Kolk now believes that physical movement, yoga, eye movement therapy, EMDR, that those are in fact at least as effective as talk therapy. And I think it must depend on the person, and we learn more and more about PTSD now. We are learning more and more because there's a very large sample. But I don't think we're going to discover that there's a magic bullet or that one treatment is good for everyone. I mean, people come into, for example, war, soldiers come with very different histories, and why they react the way they do depends at least in part on their history and their biology.
Right. One of the things I also found intriguing about your book, as someone who has spent a certain amount of time thinking about how women in particular are in the world, how they've been historically, you know, how we are at this moment in time when we are different from how we have been historically and becoming more different every day, is the ways in which, you know, rape is a weapon of war, and the experience of being being treated or of being assaulted is not... is perhaps less common now than in other moments in history, at least in certain nations. And to what extent these experiences, and you add together to that the effects of, you know, constant childbearing, and you add to that many other things that were characteristic of the way that women lived, and you sort of add that all up to the sort of stereotype of how women used to be, you know.
What do you mean? The stereotype of how women used to be? I'm not sure.
Well, like if you read a lot of the, you know, 18th and 19th century descriptions and ideas that people were pushing against, this idea of sort of irrationally fearful, for example, being a large one.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And the fainting fits, hysteria.
Right, which, you know, some of which might have had just to do with corsets at a certain moment in history and not being able to breathe properly. But, you know, but especially this idea of sort of irrational fears, you know, superstitiousness, looking for talismans.
I think that there is that fear of rape is actually common. That's what I'm reading. And I think it is, I mean, we are vulnerable. I mean, but the idea of rape as a weapon of war, I mean, it actually makes a lot of sense to me now that I've really, really explored what my rapist experienced and also kind of interrogated myself about what the rape did to me. I mean, I really came to believe that it was a way to discharge shame, to almost inject one's own shame into another person. And that shame is a kind of contagious disease. And I think that that may be part of what is happening when rape is used as a weapon. It's a way to humiliate not only the woman, but the whole nation when it's used in war.
And to have after effects that linger for generations.
Yes.
Not just in the creation of new people, but in the creation of sentiments amongst those who raise them.
Yes, the intergenerational transmission of trauma. But somehow people are resilient, and as you were saying, many people, although they acquire sometimes these symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, whether because their mother was raped or for whatever reason, it is possible to use the symptoms creatively. One of the victims of my rapist who came forward is an artist, and she is just an incredible artist who does amazing work playing with sort of gender and even depiction of rape, and it's such powerful work. And I think the rape was such, it changed her permanently, but it also made it possible for her to create this work that is so moving. And I don't mean to say in any way that it was a good thing that she was raped, but she didn't crawl into a cave and disappear. She made really good use of the terror that she experienced. Mm-hmm. And I when I see doctors traveling around the world, you know, I don't know why doctors go to these very dangerous places like the ones who were just killed in Afghanistan. I don't know what gets them to start the work, but I imagine that over time they must get, many of them, symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, which may make it easier for them to continue doing the work. And they're really doing good works. I don't know what happens when they come home, but they're able to serve in a way. So I think we shouldn't get, you know, it's important to realize that there is the possibility of post-traumatic growth and resiliency, and one can have both post-traumatic growth at the same time that one can be harmed. It's possible to have both at the same time.
One of the other things that occurred to me in reading your book, and this is the sort of thing I would mention if I were writing a review of it, but since we're talking, it feels odd to mention it, but I'll mention it anyway, is that, you know, before reading your book, I had just finally read the Stieg Larsson series, you know, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo and so on, and which are these thrillers that are basically take as many thrillers do, I hear, because I don't normally read them. You know, the subject of sexual violence. And, you know, there are these bestsellers internationally. The movie that was made out of it was, you know, the number one movie in parts of Europe. And just to read those books, which take sexual violence and in the same way that a lot of television shows do and make it the sort of subject of a crime drama, and to read your book were such completely different experiences, because one of them is really seeking to I mean the word thriller is right. I mean it sort of, you know, lifts you up to the, you know, on the top of your seat, and the other one is much more about just the subjectivity of being attacked that is described in your book is something that is extremely rarely brought into literature, it seems. And certainly is not the stuff that
you could almost hear. I was determined to get that down. I mean, I was determined to stay with the feeling that I had reading what I wrote down when I was 15 years old, and to describe what happened in my body as I was reading. And I often tell women, do not read chapter one at night, because I know that it's frightening. And I also remind people that the book is about healing, and that I promise that it will have a happy ending, because it starts out in such a frightening way. But I don't know. I just was determined to show actually potential rapists what actually happens. I mean, I did it, I have to admit, partly out of rage. Mm-hmm. I was determined that the cruelty, the violence come through, that people understand what rape does. And to me, it's, in my experience, it was sexual violence, but it was really about somebody really not caring about hurting me. In fact, wanting to hurt me and using me as an object in the most extreme way. I know there's a big debate among feminists: is sexual violence sex? And I think
right, and probably, you touch on that in your book as well.
Yeah. And I talk about that with Lucy. We had different experiences. I think that it's possible for different people to have different experiences, but also for one person to have different experiences at different times. And I tried not to make it a polemic. I wasn't
yeah.
trying to engage in any debate. I wanted to just report my own experience.
And so now, having done that, are you on a book tour with it?
Well, I've had just a small book tour, and I've been to Washington and New York City, and I've spoken in Boston, and I'd like to speak more. I mean, I think that the book isn't really, although it starts out with the rape, I don't mean it to be about rape per se.
Right.
I think it's about denial of traumatic experience, my own denial,
mm-hmm.
and the community's denial and my family's denial, the denial of the police, the denial of the rapist, and the denial of everyone who knew him, and how dangerous that denial was, how hurtful it was.
Did the police ever apologize to you? After reading the book, was anyone in the police department, did anyone say anything?
No, but really, the police officers involved in investigating the crime are retired, and the one who reinvestigated the crime, I mean, he's a hero.
Right. And it comes across that way in the book, because he ultimately puts everything together.
Yes, and I mean, it's really a good story about the police. It's a bad story about, you know, it's a story about how badly rape was handled in the early 1970s. But I think that Lieutenant McCone really serves as a model for how healing it can be to solve even a very long unsolved crime for the victim. And I think he's really done a really profound good deed for all the victims of this man.
Mm-hmm. Have you met many more of them?
I've talked to, I guess about six have come forward now, and mm-hmm. one I've talked to quite a bit, and I've met her, yes. And maybe more will come forward, but you know, it is really re-traumatizing, and so I didn't want to myself go out and contact people. I wanted them to make that decision.
And is this an area that you think you'll do any further academic work on, or is this with this book? Go on from there?
Well, there are two things I'm thinking about. One is looking at, in fact, I am part of a group looking at Somali children who are sometimes joining gangs or getting involved in violence of various kinds, including in a small number of cases, getting recruited to a terrorist group active in Somalia called Al-Shabaab. This is unlike most Muslim Americans, this community is severely traumatized. They come from a war zone, and they come here not speaking English, and they have a very different experience from most Muslim Americans. Mm-hmm. But the letters I've gotten in response to this book have really made me think that it might be interesting to look at how people move beyond trauma and, you know, a severe trauma, like a rape at gunpoint, or because it's fascinating how some people tell me the kind of the good, really, that they're doing in the world, not just in spite of the terrible things that happened to them, but actually, in a way, using their symptoms. And mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting. So I'm hoping I can do both.
Hmm. Are you familiar at all with the singer, I'm forgetting his name right now, who was he did the World Cup theme song for South Africa?
No,
he's a Somali-American rapper who sings many of his songs are really quite wonderful, are about growing up in this environment in Mogadishu of just complete violence and friends being killed when he was, you know, 12, and the girl he loved being killed and, you know, surviving a grenade attack and all these things. And now he's this American rapper. And he wrote what became the theme song for the World Cup, and it was this incredibly popular song, number one all across the world, except of course America. I can send you one.
I'm embarrassed that I don't know about it. I should. No, I'm not. So, I have to say thank you very much. I have to go pick up my son. But it's so kind of you to take an interest in my book. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, no, I mean, and thank you for agreeing to talk. I haven't and for coming onto Blogging Heads and for writing this very clear-headed book.
Thank you.
So with that, I guess we will let you return to your regularly scheduled programming, and I guess your dog will go where he wants to go.
Okay.